It's Isaiah chapter 41, verses 8 through 10. Those who are at the funeral should remember this because I did it at the funeral. If you will stand, I will read it to you. It is a very, very good three verses. But thou, Israel, art my servant Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth, and called thee from the chief men thereof, and said unto thee, thou art my servant. I have chosen thee, and not cast thee away. Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I'm your God. I will strengthen thee. Yea, your God, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. You may be seated. What a miraculous verse that is. It shows who God is the God of. But it was over 20 years ago when I was teaching high school math when one of my math students asked me a question. It was during lunchtime. We were both in my math room munching on the lunch that we brought from home. She asked this question. Have you read Peter Marshall's book, The Light and the Glory? Well, I knew a Peter and Catherine Marshall. Peter was the Senate chaplain and his wife was a best-selling author. But this was co-authored by their son. I answered, no, I was not aware of the book. What is it about? She answered, well, we are using this book in Sunday school class. It tells about the pilgrims and how God performed all the miracles for them. Well, that piqued my interest. I hadn't heard of all these miracles that God performed for the pilgrims in the early days of our nation. So after I went home, I bought the book. I read it and was fascinated. That fall, we had our Thanksgiving meal at our house. I mean the church's first Thanksgiving meal, which is, of course, around 2 weeks before the real Thanksgiving Day celebrated by our nation. We started celebrating it because we noted a lack of correct motives in celebrating it with family and friends. It wasn't supposed to be a social event and a sports day, but a religious service. God was to be thanked for his kindness and goodness towards us in giving us a good harvest. It was a part of Tabernacles. The women fixed the turkeys and all the food that went with it. We must have had around 40-plus people at the meal. We had tables and chairs all throughout our house. Before the meal, I gave the sermon which told of the miracles that God performed for this small group of people, the pilgrims, less than several hundred. And I began a new practice. I put 5 kernels of corn on an empty plate of each person before we feasted on our meal. Now, if you listen to the sermon, you'll find out why I did that. I did this for about 10 years. I know that I talked too long, and it was difficult to keep all the food warm, but I think my audience was just as intrigued with the message as I was. So every year I would bring a sermon so we could remember how God provided his great miracles to the pilgrims so they could survive. It is the realization of how much God's hand had played a part, not only in America's founding, but indeed in its very discovery. Well, it's been quite a few years since I brought a sermon about this day. But today I will bring you an updated message of the miracles shown to the pilgrims almost 400 years ago. The pilgrims saw themselves as called into their new promised land in order to found a new Israel, which would be a light to the whole world. They were actually the fleshly inheritors of Joseph's birthright. They received the most beautiful land that was full of all the natural resources necessary to provide for a wonderful life. Coal, petroleum, natural gas, fertile soil, numerous waterways, forest, gold, silver, copper, venison, fish, bison, wild turkeys, on and on it goes. And there were only about 1,000 pilgrims in the entire world. When the majority of them had escaped to Holland from England, only 1,000. But they changed the world. Now, later on in Holland was a group of Huguenots in Holland and France. The Vissers are from the Huguenots. He traced his lineage back to there. They went from they were massacred by the Roman Catholics. They fled and went to South Africa in 1752. Half my family's Huguenot. The Jewetts are Huguenots. They went to England and to America. So maybe the Vissers of the Jewetts knew each other. They had been hounded, bullied, forced to pay assessments to the Church of England, put into prison on trumped-up charges, and they were driven underground. They met in private homes, to which they came at staggered intervals and by different routes, because they were constantly being spied on. In the little town of Scooby, persecution finally reached the point where the congregation to which William Bradford belonged elected to follow those other separatists, who are also known as pilgrims, who had already sought religious asylum in Holland. After being in Linden, Holland for about 12 years, these separatists were ready to move again. The hard 11 to 15-hour working days and low-paying jobs had aged them more than normal. They had to get the large sum of money for the trip, and many of them were ready to go. They believed that they would be, quote, a city set on a hill, unquote. I'm going to tell you a few of God's miracles. I'm not going to tell you all of them. It would take way too long, but it's a fantabulous story that were showered on the pilgrims. The first miracle. The separatists came to believe that America was the place to which God intended them to go, despite the horrors of Virginia's starving time. They needed a lot of cash to go on this transatlantic voyage. So all the families that were going on this transatlantic journey sold their homes and all their immovable possessions in order to give their agent cash with which to purchase shares in the plantation venture. Their first application was with the Virginia Company. They were the main corporate enterprise in the business of backing such ventures to America. But at this time, the Virginia Company was on the brink of bankruptcy, and the pilgrims were spared from all these entanglements. Well, how are they going to go there? They were then paid an unexpected visit by a London merchant by the name of Thomas Weston. He promised them he had a group of investors who could help them. The pilgrims decided, with some misgivings, to enter into agreement with Weston to be their agent. It was an agreement that proved to later be a mistake that violated God's laws. But their agreement started out that each adult, 16 years and older, would have one share worth about 1,400 modern dollars, and another if he outfitted and equipped himself. Those with extra funds could buy more shares. They would all continue in joint partnership for how many years? 7. Why? the standard period of biblical indentured service, at the end of which time, 7 years, all land and profits would be divided up according to the number of shares. Personal property, such as houses, home lots, and gardens, would remain wholly the property of the planters and would not be divided up. The planters were also to be given 2 days a week of their own. It struck them as an enmity fair agreement. The separatists sent two of their number to London to represent them, John Carver and Robert Cushman. Carver was a proven man with stability and maturity about him. Cushman, on the other hand, had a quick mind and a gift for elegance, but was immature and had difficulty accepting correction. While Carver was out of London gathering supplies for the upcoming voyage, pressure was applied to Cushman to agree to certain changes in their contract. He agreed to the changes. This agreement to changes in the contract that was made by Robert Cushman was shown to the pilgrims to sign right before they were to set sail on the Mayflower. Did they sign? The pilgrims didn't sign. They owed £60, which was paid off by selling their only food surplus, which was butter. They then wrote a letter to London that if large profits didn't arise within 7 years, they would continue with them for a longer period. When the Speedwell failed to make the journey, Robert Cushman decided not to go with the pilgrims on their initial journey. He joined them over a year later, traveling on the Fortune. After arriving in the new land, Cushman convinced the pilgrims that it was in their best interest to sign the contract. So they signed the agreement, thereby entering into bondage to the adventurers, which would see them struggle for more than 20 years to get out from under the debt that they had amassed. The pilgrims were mercilessly taken advantage of, at times having to borrow money at interest rates of 30 to 50%. Some of the unscrupulous adventurers added on bogus claims that pilgrims paid at a fearful cost. It took 25 years and 20,000 pounds, that's English money, 20,000 pounds, to retire a debt of 1,800. To accomplish this, Bradford had to sell a large farm, Alden and Standish, 300 acres apiece, and Winslow and Prince, their homes. Does this sound familiar? Now, I have a map up there. I'm going to talk about that in a second. And I'm going to tell you, what of the man who pressured Cushman to make changes in the agreement? His name was Thomas Weston. Weston, acting independent of the other adventurers, set up his own fishing enterprise just a few miles up the coast from Plymouth at Weston Gasset. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. Now it's Weymouth. When the other adventurers found out what he was doing, they expelled them from their group. Now here's Plymouth, and there's Weymouth up there. Now, it says up here, Weymouth and Hull, there's Hull, settled as part of Plymouth in 1622, and 1624 became part of the Massachusetts Bay in 1630. So this was 1620, Plymouth. This is 1622. Weston set up a fishing element up there. Things were going so poorly for Weston that in order to escape his creditors, he disguised himself as a fisherman and sailed for his fishing station at Wessagesset. When he arrived there, he found that it no longer existed. He had sent a bunch of roughnecks who had consumed a year's supply of food in 4 months and had sold their equipment to the Indians for food and remaining interested in getting and staying drunk all day long. In addition, they had provoked the Indians. They stole from the Indians. That the Indians were considering a general attack on these settlers, not just the ones at Weymouth, but also at Pilgrims, at Plymouth. That a war was about to break out if these men were not gotten under control. Finally, Standish and a few men had been forced to give Weston's rowdies an ultimatum. They were to go home on the next boat. Well, they sailed within the hour, and peace was restored. When Weston arrived at Charleston, he could not believe what he had been told about his fishing station. And with another man, he hired a ship to go see his station. But on the way there, the ship sunk. And he lost all his belongings. Knowing nowhere else to go, he finally went to Plymouth on foot. When he arrived there, he presented a very sorry sight. He begged for their mercy and for a loan of beaver skins to get him back on his feet. He promised them he would repay them in supplies as soon as the transaction was completed. Well, what do you think the Pilgrims did? The Pilgrims gave Weston the beaver skins, and Weston did eventually repay them with scorn and vicious slander. Not a penny in recompense. What a fake Christian Mr. Weston was. If you put that map to the side, we can put it back up later. And we got the next slide. The second miracle. The plan was to leave Delfshaven, which was in Holland, to go to Southampton, England, on the little boat, the Speedwell. I think most Christians don't know about this boat, the Speedwell. They would join a larger merchant ship, the Mayflower, which was in England. But only 200 out of the 600 pilgrims would or could go. They left on July 22nd, 1620. Now look how faithful these people were. On the dock, their pastor, who was John Robinson, slowly knelt, and all of the others followed his lead. As he solemnly invoked God's blessing on their undertaking, tears came to all of their eyes. And even the young men wept unabashedly. They prayed. They prayed. Quickly they boarded the ship, and the crew cast off. Well, the Speedwell came at Southampton, where the two men who were representing the Pilgrims, Carver and Cushman, rejoined the Pilgrims. It was at Southampton, when the two ships were just about ready to sail, that Weston chose to present his revived contract for the Pilgrims to sign. He thought that this was a good time that they would knuckle under, but they didn't. When the Pilgrims refused to sign, Weston stormed off back to London, and the two boats left for the New World on August the 5th, 1620. But after just 3 days on the Atlantic, it became obvious that the Speedwell was in trouble. Her seams were letting in ocean water, so they had to turn back to the nearby port of Dartmouth. 1 week later, they tried it again, so the two boats leave Dartmouth, only to encounter the same problem. This time they sailed to Plymouth, England. While there, they made the difficult decision to sell the Speedwell and combine her passengers and cargoes with those on board the Mayflower. But like what happened to Gideon's army, though not as drastic, the number of pilgrims who were taking the trip were almost cut in half. There were only 102 pilgrims who made the journey to America. They had to stay under the deck of the Mayflower, with the exception of the women and small children who stayed in the captain's quarters. Now, put the picture of the Mayflower up there, and we'll have to get... Rand and I, we went to Boston about 20 years ago. While there, I had read this book, and I was interested in seeing the Mayflower. They have a replica of the Mayflower stationed right in the bay where the Plymouth Plantation was. And there's also Plymouth Rock, which got 1620 on it. So we saw that. The Mayflower, we couldn't go on because it was the middle of winter. But it's not a very big boat, and the pilgrims stayed down here. I don't know where the captain's quarters are, where the women stayed. One child was born on the way. Left 102, he came back with 103 who made it. But there was also other strangers besides the pilgrims on this voyage. Among the strangers was a bootsmith, his wife and two children, a cooper that each ship was required to have, and there was the crew and the captain. Robert Cushman was also a casualty of the Speedwell's demise. He decided to delay his trip to the New World for over a year. Part three is what we have next. Now we come to one of the most miraculous stories in the book, in my opinion. It tells of the seven-week ship ride full of many difficulties, in addition to many hardships. There was the harassment from the sailors. Several of the crew had taken to mocking them, that's the pilgrims, unmercifully. And their self-appointed leader had taken such a dislike to the pilgrims that he would gloat at their seasickness and in telling them how much he looked forward to feeding them to the fish when they died. His favorite cry was calling them, quote, psalm singing, they sang the psalms, puke stockings, unquote. We would say that he was a great bully, one of the greatest bullies of all time. What do you think happened? What would you do if you were a pilgrim, hearing those vicious, verbal, torturous outbursts? Well, at the peak of this tormenting, this same crewman suddenly took gravely ill of an unknown fever and died within a single day. No one else caught this mysterious disease, and he was the first to go over the side of the boat. No more mocking from the crew. What a great deliverance from an unnecessary nuisance. And no pilgrim died on the voyage to the New World. The fourth miracle. And this is a marvelous story too. Shortly after passing the halfway point to America, so there are about 3.5 weeks, the Mayflower ran into a violent storm. We may have one this afternoon. The huge crossbeam supporting the main mast had cracked and was sagging alarmingly. The crew couldn't budge it. But the pilgrims did what the crew couldn't do. What did they do? They prayed to their God. After saying their prayers, they then remembered the great iron screw of the printing press that they had brought. They brought a printing press from Holland to England to the New World. That shows what their priorities were. They printed the books they found worthy of their beliefs. Remember, it was 1620. And the printing press was a relatively new invention. They found the giant screw, and cranked it up till the beam was back into its original position. The Mayflower was saved from destruction. It was one time the sailors joined the pilgrims in praising God. The ship could have sunk and everyone drowned in the Atlantic Ocean. What a joyous occasion that was. Well, now I'll tell you about the fifth miracle. The area where the pilgrims landed was the land where the, and I have a hard time with this word, Patuxet. They were a large white man murderous tribe of Indians lived. They did not like the white man at all. Of all the tribes in North America, the history says they hated the white man the most. And there's a reason for that, which we'll get to. But in 1616, a mysterious plague broke out, killing every man, every woman, every child. It completely wiped out this Indian tribe. So complete was the destruction that the neighboring tribes had shunned the area ever since, convinced that some great supernatural spirit had destroyed the Patuxets. But that's not the whole story. So the Patuxets are wiped out. But there was one of the Patuxets by the name of Squanto, had been captured by an English sailor in 1605. So it's 11 years before the tribe was wiped out. And he was taken to England. While there, he and the other prisoners were taught English. He returned to America 9 years later in 1614 by helping an English sailor who was a fisherman with the translations with the Indian tribes along the northeastern coast of the future United States. But while he was living in the land where the pilgrims would come in 6 years, he was recaptured. It was a dirty trick played by another fisherman. He lured him on board to trade and he captured him. He was taken and sold as a slave in the nation of Spain. He was purchased by a Roman Catholic monastery. After a short stay, he returned. Well, later he left the monastery and went to England. After a short stay, he returned to his homeland, the present Massachusetts, in the year 1619 by being a guide and a translator to an English fisherman. So he was captured in 1605, went to England, learned English, and was used by the fishermen to translate with the Indians. He was taken back home in 1614. Then he was made a captive again, taken to Spain. The monastery got him. Then he left the monastery and went back to England. And he got another ride to the New World from another English fisherman. He would, if I talk to the Indians, will you let me off at my home? He said yes. So in 1619, when he returned to where he was born, he discovered that all of his tribe were dead. That means his mother, if she was still alive, his father, grandfather, grandmother, brothers, sisters, aunt, uncles, cousins, neighbors, friends, enemies, they all were gone. And the other Indian tribes didn't move in there because they thought some supernatural thing had killed them all. As a result, he was staying with another tribe. Now, if you put the map up there, I'll show you where he was staying. He was staying with another Indian tribe that was 50 miles away from where the pilgrims were dwelling. Here's the first landing of the Mayflowers way up here. You see this hook here? What's this called? Cape Cod. The pilgrims first landed here. There were some Indians here. They fought some Indians, but no one was killed. But here's where they made their home. Well, this is where the Patuxets lived. And here is where Squanto lived. So this land was all vacant.
God's providential
care is amazing to me. When he heard of their arrival, he was anxious to see them. He heard of them from another Indian, from another tribe, who also spoke English.
Now, that Indian tribe was from up here, which is now the state of Maine.
He also learned English. Does anybody know his name? Samoset. He went to the pilgrims. He was a lone Indian who went to the pilgrims. They said, "Indian coming." And they got their rifles and muskets, whatever it was, and the Indian went in there and he said, "Welcome." After the Indians heard that, they answered the same way, "Welcome." Then Samoset said, "Have you any beer?" They brought him some brandy and a biscuit with butter and cheese, and then some pudding and a piece of roast duck. They didn't keep all the health laws. He cleaned his plate. Where did an Indian learn to like English food? And where did he learn to speak English? Samoset explained that it was from him that he learned of what happened to the land where they now dwelt, the former territory of the Potawatomis. He told them that the corn that they had found hidden under the brush was corn that was grown and harvested by the Potawatomis before they died. He explained, and the pilgrims knew, it was God's providence in giving them a vacant land instead of a land of the most white man-hating Indians in North America. That is incredible. Well, Samoset left the next morning and returned a few days later with another Indian. He, too, spoke English. The first two Indians they met spoke English. And it was an Indian from the very tribe where they now live, which was all destroyed. It was Squanto. Squanto, who had been in England since 1605 with a couple little interventions in between, took that it was his job to help his English settlers succeed. And help them he did. Without Squanto's help in farming and fishing and trading with the other Indian tribes, Plymouth possibly could have failed. One thing that Squanto showed his pilgrim friends was to eventually save every one of their lives. He showed them how to plant corn the Indian way, hoeing 6-foot squares in towards the center, putting down 4 or 5 kernels, and then fertilizing the corn with fish. At that, the pilgrims just shook their heads. Fish? In 4 months, they had caught exactly 1 cod. 1 fish in 4 months. 4 or 5 fish in each hole? No problem. In 4 months, Squanto said the creeks would be overflowing with fish. Squanto instructed the young men how they would make the nets to catch the soon-arriving fish. The men obeyed what Squanto told them, and in 4 days, the pilgrim would catch an enormous amount of fish, as the fish were making their spring run. But there was another problem. The wolves. For they would attempt to steal the fish that was buried in the ground as fertilizer. The pilgrims would have to guard the corn for 2 weeks until the fish had a chance to decompose. The pilgrims followed Squanto's words, and as a result, they had a wonderful harvest. God had granted them a helper from the tribe of the Indians who would have slaughtered the pilgrims as soon as they set foot on the land if they had not been killed by the mysterious plague. Their helper had been captured as a prisoner twice and had lived in England, and the second time lived in both Spain and England. And I wonder if Squanto had heard about the bad treatment that the pilgrims had received in England while he was living there. Because 1605 is when the pilgrims went over to Holland. I'm sure he could have heard, no doubt did, about these people who had separated from the Church of England.
The sixth miracle.
The second crop of 1623 experienced a great drought of 12 consecutive weeks, almost 3 months of no rain. No rain for 3 months? Have you ever experienced such a time? I've come close. The crops were within 1 day of dying, and if they died, Plymouth would die of starvation. What would the pilgrims do? What would you do? You turn to our God. That's what the pilgrims did. They turned to their God. They went to the church building and began their prayer session. They prayed all morning. They prayed all afternoon. In the late afternoon, they heard the pitter-patter of a light rainfall. It was the beginning of the greatest turnaround in weather, from one of the worst droughts to a time of intermittent rain and sunshine that had provided a great harvest. You couldn't have a big rainfall because it would just knock the plants over. It had to be just a gentle rain, then sunshine, then a gentle rain, sunshine. It was perfect. The Indians had never seen anything like what happened. They, too, were in awe of the marvelous weather that occurred after the major drought. The God of the pilgrims had given them mercy to keep them alive. They had gone from almost starving to death to a time of great surplus as a result of their wonderful harvest. In the fall of 1623, they celebrated Thanksgiving along with the wedding service of William Bradford. Bradford lost his wife. She fell out of the Mayflower into the water and drowned. You talk about a tough time. Bradford placed how many kernels of corn? 5 kernels of corn on each empty plate of the receptionist. This is his wedding reception. He did this before they received any of their soon festive amounts of food. He did this so they might not forget the recent history of rationing their food during the severe drought they had suffered through. Now put the picture of Bradford up there for a second. This is William Bradford. This occurred after another ship, the Fortune, arrived that brought more settlers to Plymouth. It came 1 year after pilgrims arrived in Plymouth, but they brought no food supplies for the colony, as well as no clothing, no tools, and no bedding. They entered their own starving time that winter and were ultimately reduced to a daily ration of 5 kernels of corn per person. It's almost inconceivable how life could be supported on this small amount of food. But the pilgrims had a choice. Either to give in to bitterness or to go into a deeper relationship with their God. Would they choose? They chose the latter. And they survived in a most marvelous way. Unexpectedly, what happened? A ship pulled into their harbor on its way back to England from Virginia. While the captain had no extra food, he did have beads, knives, trinkets, and so forth, which the pilgrims could trade for corn. The captain would buy beaver pelts from the pilgrims. Thus they thanked their God from seeing them through the winter. Their God saved their lives from starvation again. Now the seventh miracle. The first winter, there was a time of quote-unquote general sickness. The pilgrims started dying. That winter, they lost 47 people, nearly half of their original number. The children fared the best. None of the 7 daughters died, but only 3 of the 13 sons. And the colony, which was young to begin with, was even younger now. And through it all, their hearts remained soft towards God. Where they knew what they were being tested, as Bradford later suspected, the high point of their week remained which day? Sunday. Sunday worship. When the beat of the field drum would summon them to the morning and afternoon service. 4 hours in the morning and 3 or 4 hours in the afternoon. They met way longer than we did. The service was held in the blockhouse at the top of the hill. It was the center of their community. Then they built their homes around the church. Inside, on the rough-hewn log benches, the men would sit on the left side, the women on the right side. William Brewster would preach, and he had a gift for teaching both powerfully and profitably, to the great contentment of the hearers and their comfortable edification. Yea, many were brought to God by his ministry. Many who lost a spouse remarried at Plymouth Plantation. In May of 1621, they had their first wedding at the plantation. Edward Winslow and Susanna White had both lost their spouses that winter. They were married by Governor Bradford. Oh, they didn't go to the state and get a license. In the fall of that year, they held their first Thanksgiving service. It lasted 3 days, and the Indians were invited to be with them. The Pilgrims and Indians competed in shooting contests with gun and bow. There was also a competition of foot races and wrestling. But the highlight of the Thanksgiving Day was at its beginning. It was William Brewster's prayer that the Pilgrims remember the most. He said they had so much for which to thank God for providing all their needs, even when their faith had not been up to believing that he would do so, for the lives of the departed, and for taking them home to be with him, for their friendship with the Indians. That was so extraordinary when settlers to the south of them had experienced the exact opposite. They were slaughtered by the Indians. For all his remarkable providences in bringing them to this place and sustaining them. The eighth miracle is, what did the Pilgrims believe? They disagreed with the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church and said that they had strayed beyond Christ's teachings and had established religious rituals and church hierarchies that went against the teachings of the Bible. This put them in difficulty with church officials, who tried to have them arrested and thrown in jail for refusing to participate in church rituals. While in Holland, the Pilgrims strictly honored the Sabbath day by not performing any labor on Sunday. They studied the writings of early Protestants and separatists such as Martin Luther and John Calvin. The Pilgrims believed that before the foundation of the world, God predestined to make the world, man, and all things. He also predestined at that time who would be saved and who would be damned. Only those God elected would receive God's grace and would have faith. There was nothing an individual could do during their life that would cause them to be saved or damned, since God had already decided who was going to be saved before the creation of the world. However, God would not have chosen a blatant sinner to be his elect, and therefore, those who were godly were likely to be the ones that God had elected to be saved. That's the first reason I heard when I asked in school, what's a Calvinist that the Pilgrims were? And that is what Calvinism is, because I became a Calvinist. This is what is known as Calvinism. This is what John Calvin and Martin Luther taught. It is wrong. Well, why did God provide all the miracles for these people if they were wrong? God looks on the hearts of his elect people. They had come and suffered at a great price away from the Antichrist Roman Catholic Universal Church and the Church of England. But they failed to go far enough. But they made great strides. They missed the jump to covenant theology. They were the people who inherited the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were their descendants. That's one reason we are told to look to Abraham. We have had the advantage of seeing all the mistakes and false doctrines that have been put out by Protestants and Catholics alike. It is the covenant doctrine that will hold to be the truth and faithful doctrine that will unite our people. We are living 400 years closer to the end. There are many more miracles to look at. The pilgrims, you know, were supposed to land in Virginia, but were prevented from going there by a vicious storm. The pilgrims then decided to live in Plymouth, which is located in Massachusetts. They were free from any charter, so they had to establish their own government. At this time of year, 393 years ago, they wrote and signed the Mayflower Compact. You may not know, but the pilgrims did not wear the dark clothes that are worn in plays and schools, but wear clothes of modest but different colors. It was their religious cousins, the Puritans, who were shortly to follow the pilgrims to America, who had these restrictions on dress. The Puritans lived up in, moved into Boston, which is a little bit farther to the north. I found this very interesting. I found this. Squanto, when he was about to die, he died in 1622, asked Governor Bradford if he would pray for him so that he could go to the Englishman's God in heaven when he died. He also asked Bradford to give him various things as gifts to his English friends back at Plymouth. Within a few days, Squanto was dead. I can guess what the governor answered Squanto, for he was a Calvinist. But this was their big error. If Bradford was of the Christian identity belief, I know what he would have told Squanto. The pilgrims were a people who read their Bibles and discovered that the church and their nation was wrong. What should they do? What did they do? They separated and came out of that anti-Christian church and then started their own church. What a good thought. May we learn from their lesson. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel. Amen.